Welcome to the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Kevin Barrett, the Boy Wonder, on Mondays and Fridays, and Jim Fetzer is usually here the middle 3 days. Today I'm your guest host, Morgan Reynolds, sitting in for Jim, as well as tomorrow. And I've got some exciting guests. Yesterday I had Dr. Gary North. Today I have Dr. Pam Fried, Executive Director of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation in Philadelphia. And tomorrow I will have Dr. Judy Wood, a leading 9/11 researcher and PhD engineer, along with John Hutchison, famed for the so-called Hutchison effect or anti-gravity effect. My special guest today is Dr. Pam Fried. She spells that F-R-E-Y-D. She has a doctorate in education. I invited her on the Dynamic Duo ultimately to get her assessment about eyewitness testimony in general in the courts and outside the courts, but especially get her comments about witness testimony about the traumatic day called 9/11. Now, what I found out in the last few days is that I have touched on a highly sensitive area, perhaps more so than the 9/11 issue, because we've got sexual abuse, molestation, pedophilia, the family really is a social institution, I think, is at work here. The exploitation of children, real or imagined. And Pam, as executive director of an organization that seems to play a prominent role on this issue, she's director of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, and that website is fmsfonline.org. Pam, why don't you tell me a little bit about your background and then how the foundation came about?
Well, my background, as you mentioned, is in education, and I've been involved with teaching at virtually all levels.
Is that in the area of science or different subjects?
I started out as a regular classroom teacher, but I became involved in science research education and involved with some National Science Foundation grants in the area of science. So that was how I ended my teaching career.
Okay, now then, the foundation was founded when, in the early 90s?
The foundation was started in March of 1992, in a response to what was then an exploding situation of mostly women who were claiming that they had suddenly recovered memories of having been sexually abused. These memories were recovered while they were in some kind of therapeutic environment. These are people who, until they were in that therapy, had no idea that they had ever been abused and basically had reasonable relationships with their families.
Now, when I Googled your organization, I got, the first six listings were, seemed to be attack pieces or pieces against the False Memory Syndrome Foundation and its apparent position on the issue of recovered memory and the whole syndrome thereabouts. And that, right away, that's Reynolds rule number one. If it's controversial, the mainstream is wrong. It's a pretty good rule of thumb, be it economics or medicine, and it seemed to me in this area. Is that what's going on there? Are these there are a number of attacks. I've actually got a couple of emailers in advance who are concerned that we won't get a balanced treatment here. One of these emailers directed me to one Dave McGowan. who has a website called The Conformist, spelled with a K. Are you aware of
him? I'm not aware of that. No, there are many, many things on the web. I can tell you that the foundation did generate a tremendous amount of publicity and hostility and also favorable comments when we were formed, because what we did was it was kind of an in-your-face approach. However, it seemed at the time that was what was needed, because people were being accused on no other basis than these claims of recovered repressed memories that were happening in therapeutic situations, almost entirely where hypnosis or sodium amytal, dream interpretation, or guided imagery, certain techniques of that sort, were used in an effort to recover memories. And it's been known for, you know, some time that all of these techniques are highly suggestive techniques, and the problem is that once those techniques are used, it's very difficult to know the truth or the falsity of what a person may think he or she has remembered. And particularly if hypnosis is used, the person who's undergone hypnosis is intensely confident of, you know, his or her belief in what has happened. To counter the criticisms, one need only look at the advisory board of the foundation, such luminaries as Aaron Beck.
And Aaron Beck is who?
Aaron Beck is the father of cognitive therapy. Ulrich Neiser, Elizabeth Loftus, very famous memory researchers. Paul McHugh, who was chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins for over 25 years. Just a stellar group with many people who were involved with the National Academy of Science. So the advisory board is very strongly and scientifically oriented. Most of our criticism comes from people who are based more in belief rather than in some of the scientific data.
Mm-hmm.
Does that explain it a little?
Well, you sent me one article I thought that was excellent, which basically centers on this, what I would call scientism in the therapeutic community, as embodied, it seems, by the American Psychology Association, the APA.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, there's this new split-off and growing organization called the American Psychological Society. And they're more into psychological research, science, you know, the usual kind of hypotheses and validation by objective data or refutation of hypotheses, whereas the therapeutic community, the psychological, the clinical psychology doesn't seem to have this same ethic for science. That's my layman's impression. And one of the things that really bothers me about so many therapists is they don't seem to have the Hippocratic Oath in their hip pocket, first do no harm. Well, we will be back with more interesting talk about false memory, repressed memories, with Pam Fry. Interviewing Dr. Pam Fried of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation in Philadelphia. And the other side of the break, I was saying that one of the ways to distinguish which side seems to be the good guys and which side's bad guys is which side really uses the scientific method to sort through the competing claims. Pam, one way I really recall getting into this just tangentially was during the 1980s, when there was all this so-called preschool abuse There were a couple of scandalous cases. One I followed very closely was the Amaralts in Massachusetts, because I was a daily reader of the Wall Street Journal, and Dorothy Rabinowitz was covering that, and it seemed like a gross injustice was done to the Amaralts, where Gerald Amaralt served 18 years behind bars, and his mother and wife, I think, both served 8 years. You recall that case?
Oh, yes, I do. I think, you know, I think we should just sort of say, and I'm sure you agree with me, that we know that there is, you know, far too much child abuse that goes on. However, in the zeal to counter that child abuse, a wave of emotion and a wave of actions and a wave of thinking took over that kind of made a juggernaut, where people were acting on their emotions rather than taking a pause and looking carefully at the evidence that was presented. And that's why in some of the child care cases, you have so many of them with such bizarre claims about being thrown on rooms and clowns doing, you know, weird things and so on.
Animal butchery, assaults by a bad clown, secret rooms, magic potions, right?
Things that if one stopped to think about it in whatever environment they were in would be pretty impossible to accomplish. And if they knew then what is known now about interviewing children, I think some of the overreaction might have been slowed a bit, too.
So we're in better shape today from a justice point of view than we were then, perhaps?
Oh, I think we've come a long way in people understanding how easy it is with either children or adults to have people in an environment that's suggestive so that they can come to believe things that may not have happened. I think maybe we should just pause and talk about general memory for just a minute.
Okay.
And in fact, you know, if we talk about memories, some of our memories are true. Some memories are a mixture of fact and fantasy. And sometimes we remember things that are totally false. And most of the time in this life, it really doesn't matter because, you know, you might have an argument at the dinner table about what happened when or who saw what and so on. But it began to matter when people were making accusations based on nothing more than memories without any kind of evidence.
Yes, go ahead.
I was going to say it's a very constructive process. People used to think that memory was like a videotape recorder and you would put something in and then, you know, you could get it out just the way it was and maybe you use hypnosis. The problem was finding the right dial and finding the spot in your memory. But we now know that that's not the case at all about memory. Memory is highly creative. And at all times, what we put into our storage are bits and fragments of the things that happen around us. And not everything do we even actually put in our memory storage. And when things are in their memory storage, the circuitry and neural behavior then, you know, degrade what's there. And then we have the problem of when we recall a memory. And when we recall a memory, we take those bits and fragments that we're able to retrieve and we weave them together to make a coherent story. And that coherent story is something that needs to make sense to us in the here and now.
Yeah, that's for sure. We drive for coherence, even if it's a completely faulty explanation. You see that on 9/11 witness testimony. But now, some of us are better at it than others, right? I mean, we all have imperfect memories, the faulty memories, but some people are, I guess, in better touch with reality. But one thing I notice, isn't it true that women have a much better apprehension of a lot of these details and more accurate memories in some respects than men? Or can we make that generalization?
I don't know that I would want to do that. I think that individuals can remember, you know, it depends on the context in which things are happening and how focused somebody is on, you know, a particular topic.
Mm-hmm.
Schoolwork and so on, girls very often excel in things that require verbal memory. But in terms of remembering all of the things that happen in life, I'm truly not sure on that.
I recall one experiment, the psychological experiment that I saw on television once. They were reporting this university experiment where they had undergraduate males and undergraduate females participate, in which they just sit them down in a professor's office or an office, and they'd have them wait for 10 minutes, and then they'd question them about what they recall about this room. And the males they'd report two or three things, and they'd run out of observations, whereas the women would go on and give you half a dozen or a dozen features about the room.
That could well be. I'm just not acquainted with that particular research.
Right. Yeah. There was an article here that this so-called warfare between therapists and scientists, which I thought was an excellent article. It came from the Chronicle of Higher Education by Carol Tavris, and she reports, for example, that therapists believe memory works like a tape recorder. You were addressing that, clicking on at the moment of birth or nearly so, and yet the data don't support that. Well, we'll talk more about whether we've got a good memory machine in our head or not, more with Pam Fried on the other side of the break. I am guest hosting Morgan Reynolds, sitting in for Jim today. And my guest today is Dr. Pam Fried. Tomorrow I will have Dr. Judy Wood, a leading 9/11 researcher, along with John Hutchison. And Pam, before the break, we were talking about the quality of people's memories, and I wanted to give the listeners one example of a study that Professor Elizabeth Loftus out at the University of California at Irvine did, in which her group prepared memory booklets for 24 adults, and they inserted a false story about each of these individuals being lost in the mall, a shopping mall, at age 5. And 7 of these subjects remembered it, and they added detail. So to me, my reaction to that is that shows the power of suggestion would be, I guess, the street language for it. And to me, it also suggests that authority figures and people in positions of trust can control some people's minds or manipulate people.
Yes, I'm not even sure that, you know, you want to use the word as strong as manipulate. If people hold certain beliefs that the world operates in a certain function, in a certain way, then those around them are going to pick up on that. And so if a therapist held the mistaken belief that if somebody had been sexually abused, and it would have been so bad that they forgot it, and that's the reason that they wouldn't have any memory of it, and that the therapist is in a position of knowledge and trust and is able to use certain techniques to help that person get those memories back, and that the person isn't going to be well unless those memories do come back, it can lead to some difficulties because it opens the door for false memories about all kinds of things to develop. And I think that Elizabeth Loftus's example in the it's started out as the Lost in the Mall experiment, and it's been replicated by other people in many other scenarios now. It's a very robust phenomenon, and about 25% of the people in the studies generally end up with some kinds of false memories. But it shows how easy it is for people to adopt whole scenarios that weren't true.
And you reviewed this book, I think it was called Switch in Time by Richard Baer, where he replays this one patient. It's about the book is about one patient, his diagnosis. Isn't that an example of the poor outcomes that a therapist sometimes produce?
Well, I happen to think that that book is certainly an example of how a patient and a therapist in an environment that's been supportive of the belief system that I mentioned before about recovered memories can come to create a whole world of things that probably never happened. I mean, I can't say for sure whether something happened or not because that's way beyond my province. And in most cases, we would have to say neither can therapists if they, you know, have no kind of independent corroboration. And in fact, that's what the American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Association have all agreed that the only way to know the truth or the falsity of a memory, whether that memory is a continuous memory or whether it's one that's been recovered after memory many years, is through some kind of external corroboration.
Yeah, let's see, a psychiatrist, Judith Herman, explained on a PBS Frontline special about recovered memory, quote, as a therapist, your job is not to be a detective. Your job is not to be a fact finder. Your job is not to be a judge or a jury, and your job is also not to make the family feel better. Your job is to help the patient make sense out of her life, make sense out of her symptoms, and make meaning out of her experience, unquote.
And I think that many therapists follow that belief, and I'm not sure that by itself that it's necessarily going to cause problems unless the therapist, in working with the patient, encourages the patient to believe in the factual, in the historical accuracy of those thoughts that may have come to mind, and if then is encouraged to act on them outside of the therapy setting. As long as therapy stays in the therapy room, it's not going to, it may cause a problem for the patient or the therapist, but it won't cause a problem for others.
Well, aren't people who are, let's say, quote, mentally healthy, unquote, better adjusted to reality? I mean, isn't there something destructive to not recognize reality and deal with reality?
Yes, but I think that goes far beyond what we need to talk about if we're talking about what happens when people get false beliefs either about what they saw during 9/11, what kind of plane or whatever it was, or what they think they might have recovered, you know, as a memory. As I said before, we take the bits and the fragments that we have stored and we weave them together into a story that makes sense to us in the here and now. And if somebody believes that the cause of all their problems is due to sexual abuse, then they're going to interpret virtually everything that happens in light of that belief. And it's that kind of, that's where the problems can begin. That's why it's so important that people, you know, begin to understand the nature of memory and what we know about memory and how far we can push it.
Let me change pace here. One of our listeners says on the other side of the subject, she's concerned that this idea of false memory might have been used to marginalize people that were victims of the CIA MK Ultra project, which I think is well established. Mind control by the CIA and or their contractors, and people actually was I went to one of these 9/11 conferences, and there was a distressed man who was basically seeking counsel from Webster Tarpley, who's quite an erudite, scholarly historian of some of this stuff. And I don't know where that went, but it was weird. I'm an economist, and economists are, I think, pretty sound people in that they have a good assessment. Hey, people are self-interested. That's a given, and we go from there. But our listener says they've got she's worried that the psychiatrists are treating people who wanted to live a normal life, but they wanted to expose the evil that the CIA is trying to make them appear crazy. Well, I'll spell this out on the other side and get the reaction of Dr. Pam Fry. Today, it's Morgan Reynolds acting as your host, sitting in for Jim. And I have as a guest today Dr. Pam Pride, who is Executive Director of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation in Philadelphia. Tomorrow I have Dr. Judy Wood, a leading 9/11 researcher and PhD engineer, along with John Hutchison, famed for the so-called Hutchison effect. I was stumbling around before the break, Pam, trying to express the thoughts of one of our listeners regarding the claim that some people were victims of mind control experiments by the CIA back in the 50s and 60s. And then it was thought, well, hey, this false memory syndrome might have marginalized people, or be this whole idea of recovered memories is so often unverifiable and probably false that they were made to appear crazy or not reliable. What about that idea that the false memory syndrome can be used, if you will, to thwart the truth or outing a vast conspiracy?
Well, first, I would agree that the CIA 40, 50 years ago did unconscionable research for which they and our nation should feel ashamed. There's no question about that. They went beyond the bounds.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that the people who believe that they were involved in that research necessarily felt that they had recovered memories. That certainly has not been in the province of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. I know that there are people who've been concerned that that the whole notion of false memories would discredit people who really were abused. And I think that that certainly has not happened, and it should not happen for anybody else. It boils down to what I said before. The only way to know the truth or the falsity of somebody's claims is through external corroboration. And I understand that we've had a great deal of distrust in our government that built up since the Vietnam War, so that we don't necessarily trust them to tell the truth about what they have done or what they haven't done. But that really is far beyond my province. I can really just say that if somebody has external corroboration for what's happened, there's no reason for them not to be believed. I also understand that in some cases, whether it's sexual abuse or anything else, it may be impossible to get some kind of corroboration, and it may be that people have to live with some kind of ambiguity. I mean, it's just one of the tugs that go in this lifetime of, you know, different positions that get taken and pushed to the right and pushed to the left, and you hope that some correct balance ultimately is worked out so that those extremes are no longer relevant in the future.
There's an old saying in the law that one witness is no witness at all, which I enunciated to an attorney friend of mine, and he said, no, that's not true. It depends on the credibility of the witness. But even so, I agree with you that corroborating evidence would be necessary, certainly to convict people in a criminal court of law. Right? You need proof beyond a reasonable doubt, or there's no alternative explanation for the facts.
And that's certainly how things are supposed to work. But, you know, we've learned a lot. We used to think that eyewitness testimony, for example, was, great evidence. But what Elizabeth Loftus and many others now have shown is that eyewitness testimony is often inaccurate, and that there have been people who have been wrongly convicted on the basis of inaccurate eyewitness testimony. And that's because of what I mentioned before in terms of how our memory operates. It's a very constructive memory. It takes bits and pieces of information that it has and weaves them together. We weave it together to make a story that is coherent to us in the here and now. And depending on what people around us have said or what we've heard on television or what we may have read, that is part of the framework for what makes sense to us now. So we fit these things into to fit what we think they should be. Sometimes.
Well, there's another aspect of this to throw one more complication in, and that is, of course, people, we all know this from daily life, that as well as our own behavior, that people are not always completely honest. I was amused by one study, being a beer lover myself, where they went and counted the trash of people, so they knew how many beer cans and bottles had been disposed of, and then they went and did a survey about how much beer do you consume, and it, basically people only admitted to something like 15% of their beer consumption.
Well, you know, that points to another characteristic of human beings. We all tend to want to portray ourselves in the best possible light.
True.
And so, you know, it might not even be a real outright lie. It may, people fool themselves. We put blinders on ourselves sometimes in terms of, you know, what we do, because we know what we would like to think that we do, and sometimes report that rather than the actual facts.
A lot of social data is from questionnaires and interviews, and one thing that's long been known to economists and some sociologists is that the income is sensitive information, and when you interview people, the more questions you raise, the more income is uncovered. And a lot of this is just pretty honest memory where you, I did get that small royalty check from a gas or an oil lease or all these other nooks and crannies of income.
Yes, that sounds perfectly normal because as you start thinking about a subject, you're going to come up with, you know, more and more information on that topic. It might not be, you know, right at the top of the heap when you first start.
Yeah, so, here's another angle I wanted to raise, and that's this whole suspicious, spongy nature of so much that passes as psychology and psychiatry. I went and read a good bit of the Wikipedia write-up on Sigmund Freud. As I recall, one of my economist colleagues said, there's nothing in Freud that is science, because the sun comes up in the east, the sun comes up in the west, there's nothing false, refutable, and there's no real hypothesis that can be rejected by behavior or data. And I noticed that, and I share that impression, But I noticed that he started out with a lot of things that could fall under the repressed memories syndrome, because he always seemed to be of the idea that sex and sexual behavior drives so much. And he alleged that all of his current patients were driven by these sexual demons. Even and it didn't matter what they said, whether they talked about it or rejected that idea, they were all the same in confirming Freud's theory. Well, we'll get Pam Freud's comment or reaction about my statement about Sigmund Freud and therefore much of psychology and psychiatry when we return after our break. I am your guest host, Morgan Reynolds, having a most interesting conversation with Dr. Pam Freud of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation in Philadelphia. And Pam, I noticed on the news that actor Heath Ledger allegedly died of an accidental overdose of a prescription drug, and there's a psychiatrist by the name of Thomas Sasse, who's a classical liberal a man of my political persuasion, or could call him a radical libertarian. And he points out, he argues that, well, we have the term theocracy, we have democracy, and with the medical profession, and maybe we should throw in the psychology trade as well, we have a pharmocracy, and big pharma. Isn't there a lot of reliance on drugs in the mental health field?
Well, as a matter of fact, as Freud has faded from the mainstream in terms of how therapy works, cognitive behavioral therapy has increased, and along with drugs, and I think that your friend's comments about drugs are not the only one. He's not the only one who's been concerned that with the change in the way that therapy is paid for by the large health organizations, that maybe it's going too far in that direction.
So is your comment about Sigmund Freud that Freudian psychoanalysis is passé and not influential anymore?
It really, you know, there are very few people who are going to be paying, you know, insurance programs that will pay for that kind of therapy.
What's
replacing it is a more cognitive behavioral approach, which gets back to something that you said earlier. You had another friend who said that, you know, Freud, nobody could test him. He was not scientific. And that's
mm-hmm.
basically the problem. There's been no way to, you know, the how effective therapy treatments have been. It hasn't been measured, and it has been measured in cognitive behavioral kinds of therapy and shown certain, you know, techniques have been shown to be very successful for some kinds of problems. So that's the whole field seems to be moving in the direction of evidence-based therapy.
Well, that's good news, if true. There was one of the articles on your website was done at Washington State University, and I can't recall exactly what the subject group was, but to say it was 97% female and 97% Caucasian. I don't know if this was all tied in with default memory per se, but or recovered memories. But pre-therapy and post-therapy, there was dysfunctional outcomes. So according to this study, 83% of the patients were employed before therapy. Only 10% were employed after therapy. 77% were married before therapy. Only 34% were married after therapy. And 100% after therapy were estranged from their extended families. You
this
recall?
Was, Oh, yes. I mean, it was a shocking result when it appeared in the 90s. This was a study of people who were in therapy for having recovered memories. Most of these people actually went so far as to recover memories of being multiple personalities and being involved in satanic ritual abuse. And,
oh, yes, right. Yeah.
Right. And the outcome for these people was absolutely terrible, as it's been for people across the country who've gotten caught up in that belief system. There have been hundreds of lawsuits now brought by former patients against therapists who lost their direction in terms of, you know, common sense and encouraged their patients to adopt these bizarre beliefs and actually almost to become handicapped. So many of them went from being productive individuals to being on a disability. That aspect of this is a whole phenomenon. It's been a real tragedy. Some of those people, as I mentioned, have brought lawsuits. Many others have not, and they're trying to reclaim their lives.
But it's a good trend, even though I'm not usually a friend of the, we'll call it the trial lawyer group. This is a very good disciplinary mechanism on therapists. They've got to watch their steps, presumably. These are the right signals about what they're doing.
Well, you know, people have to be held accountable one way or another. And the way that our system operates in the United States, our mental health system, there's really a very, very little oversight of what anybody does. First of all, everybody is licensed by the state. And within any given state, there are psychiatrists that have a board, psychologists that have a board, social workers that have a board, counselors that have a board, marriage and family therapists who have their own board, and these are all separate boards with their own separate codes of behavior and so on that each group has.
Well, couldn't I go off in an unregulated way? By the way, I'm opposed to regulation. I believe in free entry, but clearly, now could I go out and hang out my shingle with, you know, the, as one writer put it, the chocolate immersion therapy? You know, $395 for the weekend and on and on.
I don't know if it's chocolate immersion. I might come.
Death by chocolate, right?
Yeah, in most of the states, anybody can set out a shingle and claim that he or she is a therapist. That does not mean, however, that those people will necessarily be able to accept somebody's insurance. In fact, they will not. It's the licensing. You know, people get their licenses and register in order to be eligible for third-party insurance payments.
Yeah, so that's driving a lot of these, the underlying economics are driving some of these outcomes. Pam, let me introduce another issue, and that is, now some people by the early 90s retracted their so-called recovered memories, and they retracted their allegations. Now what factors seem to be at play here?
Well, that's a question we ask everybody who contacts us who had this experience in terms of trying to understand what it is that causes a person to realize that they made a mistake. Often, it's because the belief system got so top-heavy. You know, there was really never any foundation for it, but it got so bizarre and so top-heavy that the whole thing fell of its own accord. I know one woman who believed in her recovered memories and satanic ritual abuse, but then the therapist began to get into either past lives or space aliens or something, and it was that. It was just a tipping point for her.
Except for today and tomorrow, I will be your guest host, Morgan Reynolds. And today I'm talking with Dr. Pam Fried of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation in Philadelphia. And Pam, before the break, you were cut off when you were talking about, well, explaining why some people in the early 90s, it seemed, began to retract their memory, recovered memory allegations. And you were claiming, well, partly it was this top heaviness where it just fell of its... Yes.
That's certainly one thing. Another issue was some people, when their insurance ran out and they were no longer seeing the therapist, so it was a break, you know, a break from the environment. For some people, it was like a life experience. If they had a birth of a child or the death of a grandparent or parent, they suddenly, you know, reflected on their relationships with their family, I guess, and wanted to set things right.
Mm-hmm.
Some people told us that it was a newspaper story that they read, and we've had a number of people who told us that it was something they saw on television or something that they read in the book that just began to click and make them question their own beliefs and the treatment they've been getting.
Now, do you attract what might be termed troubled people, scarred individuals and families who are looking for help?
Well, the people that we talk to, I mean, we just have a very narrow focus of what we do, have all explain to us that either they or someone in their family has gone into some kind of therapeutic environment and recovered memories of having been sexually abused as a child. As I mentioned earlier, there's no way that we can ever know the truth or the falsity of somebody tells us in that way.
You're right.
Of course it does.
Mm-hmm.
However, usually with these stories, there's a whole pattern of behaviors. First of all, the fact that they were in therapy and that in that therapy, certain techniques were used, such as hypnosis or guided imagery, reading of suggestive material, participation in survivor groups, and so on. That's one aspect of it. And the other, another aspect of it is that the person who makes the accusations tends to be very sure of herself and refuses to have any contact with those people that she accuses unless they confess or and enter therapy. There's not any dialogue about what's going on. There's not any discussion at any time of any kind of alternative explanations for why somebody might come to hold these beliefs. It's right and wrong. It's black and white.
And would this ordinarily be rather sudden, or would this be kind of exhausting all negotiations?
Well, from the perspective of the parents, it generally has appeared to be relatively fast and relatively sudden. That's often because they have not known what that their child was in therapy or what was going on. And they, although there may have been some distancing as it was happening, they often, you know, didn't have any context with which to put it in. And so when the accusations came, it seemed very sudden. Is that what you're asking?
And there was very little opportunity then to explain and test and perhaps persuade.
Almost every family tried to, you know, visit with their child's therapist in order to, you know, provide some information about what the family was like and so on. And this never happened. There was just absolutely no dialogue. It was either confess and enter therapy or be totally cut off.
Yeah, it seems to me that many of these therapists are self-serving, both money and power are motives for people. And they've got both as long as the patient continues in this troubled course.
I'm wary about talking about people's motives, and it could be power and control, but it could also be genuinely believing in the fact that they were helping people, genuinely believing that the cause of, you know, all problems from dandruff to athlete's foot is because somebody was sexually abused, and that the therapist has this, you know, insight and ability to help the person. I think it may be more of a problem about ignorance about memory and ignorance about the power of therapy than it is necessarily, you know, trying to be powerful.
But it is systematic behavior, so I can't believe all these therapists are just innocent of some of the damage that they're doing.
Well, first of all, only a minority of people have ever engaged in the kinds of therapy that's been, you know, confirmed to the foundation. What other people do may or may not help, may or may not be good, you know, that's certainly beyond our province. But certainly it's a minority of people. What was kind of shocking is that the profession and the field as a whole was not upset about what was going on once it began to get into the newspapers and the professional organizations became aware of what was going on, that there was not more effort within the profession to stop it from within. But since that didn't happen, as you mentioned before, the lawyers and the lawsuits served the disciplinary process there.
Outside discipline with the almighty dollar at stake. Next, I want to spend a good deal of our remaining time on 9/11 and see what you might comment on witnesses. And in particular, the airliner crashes alleged on 9/11 are in dispute, and we do get some conflicting witness testimony on 9/11 on airliners. So let's learn on the other side of the break what Dr. Pam Pride has to say. Hey, Pam, I was trying to get us steered into the 9/11 issue, and one of the controversies is over airliners. Were there four airliners that crashed or not? Has the government really provided evidence that such happened as claimed? And I recall back the first few days after 9/11 where then National Security Advisor Condi Rice promised a white paper bringing together all the evidence in favor of the government's, the official, I call it their official conspiracy theory, followed by Colin Powell, then Secretary of State, being interviewed by Tim Russert on Meet the Press, and he chimed in, oh yeah, we're going to produce a white paper. They never did. They never offered proof for all of their claims, and they've had some, we had the 9/11 Commission, they made no effort to prove the official story was true. We've had a couple of government agencies, SEMA and NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, weigh in, but I claim they haven't proven. And I believe that at the World Trade Center, for example, the most controversial case, that we were hoodwinked, that is, we were shown fake videos. And I recognize I'm in a distinct minority yet, but where is the debris? You violated laws of physics like Newton's laws of motion. And then we get to the witnesses. Now, the witnesses, of course, are always, what should we say, questionable or maybe conflicting and all a little bit spongy. I participated in a study, a systematic study of 501 first responders, mostly from the Fire Department of New York, 501 witnesses, and first responders are credible types, right? They're supposed to be alert. They're in a crisis situation, a traumatic situation, but They're there to help. They care about people. They're trying to do rescue and recovery. And what was so remarkable about the New York Times got this data, forced it to be released, went to court to have these interviews released, which were conducted in the months following 9/11, right up through, like February 2002. And what was so striking in the study was how few testified that they heard and saw plane crashes, and later on I'll read you an example, at the World Trade Center. This this study that we did, we reviewed the data there, is on checktheevidence.com. And while I'm speaking of websites, I should plug your website here again. It's fmsfonline.org, right, Dr.
Fried?
So we've got this study reported in some detail on checktheevidence.com for those of you who are interested. But a way to characterize it is that only one in five of the first responders at 9:03 in the morning when the second plane allegedly hit claim that they saw or heard such a plane. So this is about 120 first responders are in a position to, they're either at the World Trade Center or nearby. And to me, the most remarkable thing, to give you one more fact, was how few people claimed that they heard this deafening roar of an incoming kamikaze airliner. And these jet engines, if they're going full throttle, produce 130 dB or 140 dB. It's just, it's on the, if you're within 200 feet, you're on the cusp of having permanent ear damage. You're so loud. And even 1,000 feet away, 2,000 feet away, it would be, and everybody knows what a jet liner sounds like. It's louder, they would be louder than the front row of a rock concert, being up near one of those incredibly large speakers. So to me, it was amazing when you do the data, how few people really, although millions saw it on TV, the second plane hit, how few, it doesn't look like there were thousands of witnesses who were going to testify, oh yeah, I saw this airliner, or I heard it. People should have heard it almost universally. So what's your reaction to or comment to that, Pam?
Well, first, I'd just like to go back a little bit to eyewitness testimony and how easy it is to be influenced by things. One of the early experiments of Elizabeth Loftus that set her star climbing had to do with just very simple asking people questions after she showed them some pictures of traffic accidents and so on. And if she asked, did you see a traffic light? Or if she asked, did you see the traffic light? That just the simple difference in the article would change in the person's mind whether or not they thought that they had seen a traffic light.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
more would say, did you see the traffic light, more people would say yes.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Because the inferences said it was actually there.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to understand how incredible our memories are. There's another interesting experiment. It's not directly relevant. It wasn't even an experiment, really. There had been a plane crash in someplace in Europe, and later on, researchers asked people, you know, how they knew about this plane crash, and I guess there was a series. I don't remember whether they just asked them or whether there was a series of questions that they had to check. But one of the interesting things is just the vast majority of the people thought that they had seen this crash on television, when in fact, it had never been televised.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so their minds from whatever pictures may have appeared in newspapers and so on, and from knowing, you know, what may have happened, they captured it in their mind in a way in which it was a, you know, they thought they had seen it on television. You can see how people create their
own. That reminds me of the president, George W. Bush, who made that comment over months on about three public occasions that he saw the first plane hit the first tower and commented, oh, that's a really bad pilot, because it was on television, as he said, which it wasn't. Well, not that we know of. It wasn't on publicly available television.
No, I think later they got some, did they get amateur pictures of it? I'm not
well,
sure.
There's the famous Naudé.
The second one.
Yeah,
the
there's the famous Naudé Brothers video, which didn't show up until the next day.
Yeah.
Yeah, it showed up within.
The second plane, they certainly had pictures of that. There's
oh,
no question
yes.
about that.
Yes. Yeah, it was fake, but there's plenty of pictures and lots of criticism of those. Okay, we will be back with Dr. Pam Fried and on the issue of 9/11 eyewitnesses and ear witnesses after our break. Come on back. I am your guest host, Morgan Reynolds, and I have as a guest today Dr. Pam Fried, Executive Director of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation in Philadelphia. Tomorrow I will have Dr. Judy Wood, engineer and leading 9/11 researcher, along with John Hutchison, famed for the so-called Hutchison effect. Well, Pam, here we are in our last segment, and I didn't quite leave enough time to talk this out on 9/11, but one question I had is these first responders were interviewed by their supervisors months later, and of course they're not under oath. Is there anything to saying that the immediate, suppose we had interviews during the event that morning or shortly thereafter, the same day, would those tend to be more reliable, do we know, versus
yes.
those that are months later?
Yes.
They would be.
The event. Yes.
And is there actually some social science data to that effect? I mean, like experimental, like Elizabeth Loftus might do?
Yes. There have been studies that I'm thinking of Ulrich Neiser looking at flashbulb memories. Studies that ask people just after the event to write down what it was that they saw. I think in one case, it was the assassination of Kennedy or something of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
And
even though
then,
it might be more traumatic, and a month later, it's a more considered, reflective memory.
And then they ask them a month later or a year later and so on, and with time, memories fade and change.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the first responder question, are you referring to the first plane?
No, the second.
Second
actually.
Plane.
Right.
It could
yeah,
be.
Yeah, the first so-called plane that hit would have surprised more people. We've had fewer witnesses, but the second, presumably, we'd have a lot more reliable witnesses.
I would think, but first of all, it was so noisy anyway when everything was going on.
Sirens, you mean?
Sirens, you know, screams, all
right.
kinds of things happening. And the second thing that comes to my mind, I have no idea, but that these were all first responders who were very focused on working on something.
Mm-hmm.
And their minds were focused on their job. And probably, you know, it's possible many of them just cut out.
That they wouldn't be good observers, you're suggesting. Hmm? They wouldn't be such good observers, maybe?
Not that they weren't such good observers, they just cut out things that were extraneous to the job that they were trying to do at that time.
Yeah,
I don't know. That's what occurs to me.
Yeah, that might be a factor, although my impression is that there was so much confusion initially by 9/03 that they really, a lot of them were, my impression is they were underemployed. But listen to one of these first responders, and I'd like your reaction here. This responder says, and he's one who could be called a witness to who asserts that he heard and saw the second plane hit. He says, quote, maybe about 10 to 12 minutes after that first plane, I heard another plane. Then I said to myself, we're being attacked. I ran downstairs. No sooner did I run downstairs and look up that I saw the second plane strike the South Tower. It was such a vicious hit and such a precision hit. It was unbelievable. Question, did you see or hear the second plane before it hit the World Trade Center? Answer, I never actually saw the plane, but I heard it. You could hear it coming in, and then we heard the explosion. You could hear the roar of the plane coming in. At first, I didn't realize it was a plane. I thought it was like the roar of a fire, like something had just incinerated, like a gas tank or an oil tank. It sounded like a tremendous roar, and then you heard boom, and then there was a big fire, and he goes on. What would be your comment about that?
It sounds pretty reasonable to me, doesn't it, to you?
Well, explain. Did he see a plane or didn't he?
Oh, did he or not? That I couldn't tell you.
See, at
after
one
the
point,
fact, he probably wouldn't even know whether he saw it.
Right, because at one point he says, I saw the second plane strike the South Tower. Then after a question he says, I never actually saw the plane, but I heard it.
Right, but once he knew it was a plane, you know, you can make that picture in your mind. Just
right,
like the people in that European city thought they had seen this plane crash on television, because you know what the picture would be like, and, you know, you just make sense of it in that way. So I couldn't tell you whether he saw it or whether he didn't see it, and my hunch is at this point, you know, he's probably convinced he saw it, but who knows?
He was in a perfect position, by the way, in terms of location at Liberty in Albany on the west side of West Street to see it come overhead, had he been looking or alerted, since the speed of sound should have alerted him, that thundering sound. But toward the end of the same statement, he says, I was listening to the tape this morning of the people calling up, and they were describing the plane that hit the building. Actually, so many people saw it. They actually described the plane as it came in. They said it was a military-type plane, and it was green, and it was this. I mean, I never saw the color of the plane. So, at any rate, that was one of the stronger witnesses who asserts he saw and heard a plane, yet it is. There's some doubt there. It's not a clean 0-1. Now, here's another witness, if I can find it on my desk here, get your comment. This is a guy on the street who's interviewed by Fox News. Of course, we have the video of it. And he's wearing a black Harley T-shirt, Harley Davidson motorcycle logo on this black T-shirt. And he said, probably more rapidly than I can read it, several minutes after the first plane had hit, I saw this plane come out of nowhere and just scream right into the side of the Twin Tower, exploding through the other side, and then I witnessed both towers collapse, one first and then the second, mostly due to structural failure, probably because the fire was just too intense. There's his statement.
Right, he's collapsed, you know, quite a bit of time in there, hasn't he?
He sure has.
Yeah.
That's a very compact and coherent explanation, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, really.
Well, what makes it suspicious to me is that this is the script that's been replayed in more impressive detail by the 9/11 Commission, the NIST study. The FEMA was an early one, quick and dirty, but the NIST was 3 years, $20 million, 200 experts. That's their story. Structural failure, probably because the fire was just too intense. You know, and they tell you, oh, yeah, these trusses here were weakened, and then the floors pulled away, and then there was this gigantic collapse, although they never lay that out in detail because we'd be catching them up to isn't that amazing, though? I mean, that statement was, that's the government story, really.
It was very concise.
Very concise. How could this guy be this smart? We call him the Harley Shill. He sounds like a paid. If this were an inside job, I pray you entertain that idea. Wouldn't you want to have a nice cover up and confuse the issue and have such a summary comment? I think I'd like to have that if I were doing this job.
Yeah, I think it would be something you might like, yes.
This is just too slick. It's just too, and it stood the test of time on the official explanation of what happened on 9/11. Well, I want to thank Dr. Pam Fried of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation in Philadelphia for coming on and being a wonderful guest. And I hope you'll rejoin us, listeners, tomorrow for our next dynamic duo show with Dr. Judy Wood and John Hutchison.